From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont, and Happy New Year. We are all seeing 2020, I am sure. And this is the second day of 2020, January 2nd, Thursday morning. So glad to have you with us. We have a really good show lined up for you. I'm going to tell you what we're going to have in our second hour. We're going to be talking with Ronan Levy and Jehala Dudley. Jehala Dudley is a Vermont hemp grower who shipped some hemp to New York City a couple months ago. And it was seized by the New York City police. And Ronan Levy, who had gone to pick it up, was arrested. Apparently the problem was that the police down in New York haven't quite got the memo on the difference between marijuana and hemp. So that's going to get cleared up. And now the Levies, who were supposed to get this delivery, have discovered the crop has been, it's in less good shape than it was when it first got to New York City a couple months ago. Let's put it that way, after a couple of months in police custody there. So there's that whole question. And then the Levies have filed suit, or are planning on filing suit, have given notice to the city that they will file suit, I think is the official posture, about the seizure of their product and the arrest and 33 hours of incarceration for Ronan Levy. We'll be talking with Mr. Levy and with Jehala Dudley in the second hour. The first hour is going to be a really good one, too. I've got two great guests in this morning. Tim Ash is the Senate President Pro Tem of the Vermont Senate. He gets the first mention because he came into the studio this morning and is sitting across the table from me right now. Mitzi Johnson's on the phone with us. She's the Speaker of the House, and they're going to give us a preview. It is a joint interview with the Speaker and the President Pro Tem about the upcoming legislative session and lots of issues to tackle. Lawmakers come back into session to do the second year of their biennium starting next Tuesday. The governor will be giving his State of the State address on Thursday. The first visit, I think, by the Dave Graham Show to the State House will be Friday the 10th. And we'll have a good session down in Montpelier this year. So let's get right into it. Let me go to, first of all, welcome, Madam Speaker, to the Dave Graham Show. I'm so glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
And to you as well. Tim Ash, Happy New Year, and welcome to you as well.
Thank you, David.
The Senate President Pro Tem, Senator Ash, is a Democrat, progressive, hyphenated, I believe, from Chittenden County, and Speaker Johnson is from up in Grand Isle County, represents a couple of towns up there, as well as a slice of, is it Milton, Madam Speaker?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. I thought that was the case. Alrighty. One of the things we've been seeing lately in the news about sort of upcoming stuff going to be tackled by the legislature is that last year, right toward the end of the session, Governor Phil Scott vetoed a bill which was calling for companies that were responsible for pollution to pay for medical monitoring of folks who might have been exposed to that pollution and were worried about long-term health effects. And it looks like there may be a veto override vote or two, one in the House, one in the Senate, in the cards here. Let me start with you, Mitzi Johnson, the Speaker of the House. What's it look like in the House?
Well, in the House, we had, when the bill initially passed, we had 100 votes in favor of the bill, which is the magic number needed to override a veto in the House.
Yep.
And there were, we actually had a few absences as well of people who were supporting it. So I think in the House, there is very strong support. And the recent news, both with PFOA found in schools in other districts outside of Bennington County, and with the court decision saying that the court's deciding now that, yes, companies need to be responsible for health monitoring for Vermonters affected by that company's pollution. Both of those things, I think, only strengthen the case for the bill.
They kind of push the needle toward support, it sounds like. With the court decision, is it my understanding, actually, that Judge Jeffrey Crawford last week ruled that plaintiffs, people who were worried about having been exposed to these chemicals, could sue, and they could ask for medical monitoring as part of what they would get as a result of their lawsuit. Is that how that works?
I believe so. I haven't been briefed on all of the details yet,
okay.
But I do know that. You know, one of the concerns that naysayers had about the bill was it creating gray area. And I think now that there is some legal precedent and case law saying, yeah, this could be the path forward, I think the need for for clarity through statute is even more important.
Okay. Senator Tim Ash, last time I think the Senate voted on this, was it a 19-11 vote in
That's
support?
Right. Yep.
So that is one short of a two-thirds majority. What are you going to get that last vote?
Well, it's. I hope so. I think that what we're talking about here are situations where Vermont community members are basically poisoned at no fault of their own. Some type of industrial pollutant gets in their water. The pollutant has some, interaction with the human body that could cause cancer, neurological damage, and so on. So trying to protect those people from having to bear the full financial cost of being poisoned at no fault of their own is really the goal of the bill. People, when they voted yes and no, I think there were still some question marks that some of the people had. One of them was whether this would create uncertainty for the business community. And as the speaker just said, with this federal court ruling, it actually might be that the legislation creates clarity, whereas right now there might be some gray. The other is there was some confusion about how farms would be affected in Vermont. And we had exempted farms from the legislation to make sure that they would not be subjected to various types of civil actions. And I think we just need to better communicate and educate some of the people who went in and cast their vote without maybe fully appreciating how it would work.
And let me ask you about that legal standard established in the decision by Judge Crawford last week. Do I have that right that basically he's not saying it's a slam dunk? You don't automatically get medical monitoring when you sue in federal court, but you get a chance to ask for it. Is that basically the idea?
That's exactly right. It doesn't conclude that the business will have to pay for the medical monitoring. It creates a legal pathway for the plaintiffs, who are the people who've been poisoned, to seek the dollars to pay for the medical monitoring. And that's precisely what the legislation that is on the Vermont legislative docket would do.
Yeah, it's not an automatic thing. It's not as if your town was affected by PFOA, therefore you get an annual test or whatever, or a battery of tests to check various body organs for cancer or something.
Yeah, it's effectively saying you can seek damages. It doesn't mean you get them automatically. You still have to prove that you were directly poisoned and that you had health effects as a result, or that it's likely that you will.
I'm kind of surprised that's not always already the standard in the law.
Well, sometimes paying someone's medical bills after the fact. We often hear lawsuits where someone has cancer and is able to sue the company who poisoned them. In this case, it's paying for the medical monitoring before a diagnosis to make sure that someone catches whatever the particular condition is right when it gets started to avoid longer-term health damage.
And just as a matter,
David, we should
go ahead.
We should say also that the bill. The legislation that was vetoed outlines a very clear process with some significant standards that people have to meet. This isn't a willy-nilly kind of thing. There are, if you suspect that there may be a health impact from some sort of well poisoning or something like that, then there are very specific standards that somebody has to, that testing that has to happen and processes that need to occur to be able to access those resources.
Yeah, it is interesting to me. I mean, I think the part of the problem statement here that I heard when this was up for debate last year was that even this medical monitoring, I mean, if you get sick and you have medical expenses, you're going to be treated for cancer, you can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. But even the medical monitoring itself, the test you would get on a regular basis, I've had loved ones who need to go back, for this thing called a cysto every now and then, which is basically a test to see whether cancer might be recurring, the cancer you had once before. And there's a cost there. That's hundreds or thousands of dollars just for the testing right there. So that's really what we're getting at here, right? Mitzi, Speaker Johnson?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All righty. Well, let's turn our attention to a couple of the other issues that are coming up in the legislature this year. A couple of them are starting to feel like perennials. They are flowers that seem to get renewed every year, and one of these days, maybe. Family leave and minimum wage, I have in mind here. Who wants to go first on family leave and give us an update on where that is. Would that be you, Speaker Johnson?
Either one of us. I can take it.
Okay, go ahead.
We have on both of the bills, both paid family leave and minimum wage, are up on the House calendar for consideration on the first day, on Tuesday. The committee of jurisdiction, namely the House General Military Affairs Committee, will have to review the compromise proposal sent back from the Senate. I think they put us in a very strong position as a legislature as a whole. The bills we're looking at, I think, acknowledge both the priorities and concerns of each chamber. And so I think we are well on our way to ironing out a final proposal on both of those bills that are an important step forward for Vermont's families and Vermont's low-wage workers, and still a modest economic investment in Vermont's future.
Let me ask you about the about sort of how to bring about change here and what you're changing, because you know the arguments I hear on this thing are you're going to make a bigger impact on our small businesses in the state in terms of their ability to survive and continue to thrive than you are on the lives of low wage workers. What do you make of that?
One of the big issues we are seeing, the biggest issue that we're seeing for our small businesses, for any of our businesses, and for economic development in general right now in this state, is the availability of workforce. Mm-hmm. So I think creating policies that help attract workers and attract and keep workers in Vermont is the best thing we can do for not only our businesses and our economic development, but also for our overall demographics, for getting children into our small rural schools, for being able to have vibrant communities. We need policies that attract and retain workers in this state, and things that set us apart from our neighbors, and things that that really help Vermont be a place where young people can transition out of their young adulthood into putting down roots is the most important thing we can do for our future, for economic development.
So, it sounds like what you just described, Speaker Johnson, is a net positive for businesses. In other words, business people come in to see you and they say, we're having a lot of trouble hiring workers. There just aren't enough aren't enough people who are willing to work for the wages we can offer. And so we have all these open jobs. And you see this all the time. You go to the grocery store and there's help wanted signs all over the place, or mm-hmm. gas stations, or other places around the state where historically people have worked and they tend to be sort of entry level jobs or whatever. And so you're saying to these businesses that a paid family leave policy and a slightly higher wage that could attract workers and keep them here is a net positive for your business. Are businesses coming around and starting to buy this argument, or are they still worried about, oh, look at the increased costs for us and we're going to all go out of business?
Well, keep in mind, paid family leave doesn't have a necessary cost for the business.
Okay.
A business can choose whether that is something they will choose to support or not. So businesses have flexibility there. In terms of minimum wage, the market is dictating right now that most businesses are paying higher than minimum wage, and so I don't know exactly how many businesses are affected. The other piece is that for some of these benefits, like paid family leave, and keep in mind this is not just for welcoming a new child into your family, it's also for taking care of a sick spouse, an aging parent, or an ill child. Those can be very expensive to insure and administer as a small business, and by pooling resources, small businesses can compete with much larger businesses and out-of-state businesses for, you know, for jobs with decent benefits.
All right. Hey, we have a caller on the line, a listener, Rich from Huntington. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. You know, every private business, first of all, Happy New Year to everyone.
Thanks, Rich. Same to you.
Every private business in the state of Vermont, if they feel that they're not getting a good pool of employees, they are all free to offer a higher wage, regardless of minimum wage, as long as it's above the minimum wage. They are free to offer a generous leave package. Now, pretty much every, at least full-time employer in the state of Vermont offers some form of leave. They call it vacation, they call it sick time, they call it, you know, a couple of cultural holidays. But now you're imposing on them a separate category, and it would be involuntary. So right now, every employer has the option of offering a family leave program. If it was really to their advantage, don't you think they would be lining up to do this? But instead, you're having to use the heavy hand of government to impose it on private businesses. So I just, what bothers me is the attitude that you're taking, that this is going to be a real bonanza for businesses. If they felt it was going to be a big advantage, they are free to do it now. They've always been free to do it. Why do you feel that you have to do it with the heavy hand of government?
Let me put that one to Senator Tim Ash, the president pro tem. Senator, what do you think?
Well, it's an interesting question, Rich. I would say that your point in some ways on the paid family leave program is well taken, that for many small businesses, they might not have the scale to create a program of their own or an interest in doing that. What we are proposing actually takes that burden, if you will, of providing that benefit and instead makes it a society-wide benefit, so that the government actually may or may not run it. It could be administered by a private for-profit or non-profit entity. Would provide it on an all-business basis, so that many of the small businesses who I think would like to offer these kind of benefits but struggle either financially or administratively to do it, now would have the option of whether or not they want to contribute to the program for their employees, but there would be a state program which would take care of it. It's the equivalent in some ways of the Social Security system, where instead of asking every, you know, three or four employee mom and pop business to create a Social Security program, we have one for every employee who pays in all throughout the country.
Speaker Johnson, anything to add there?
No, I think that pretty well covers it.
Okay. This is an interesting area in terms of just how much we expect businesses to do on their own and how much we require of them. Always kind of a running debate on in a lot of different manifestations as legislators meet in Montpelier and craft new laws. Let's go to another caller. Rob in Montpelier is on the line.
Yes, Dave. What resonated with me about big company, small company. You know, I left a big company with really, really good benefits for a more Vermont family-friendly company. Felt more at home. But what I will say is, you know, the benefits. My decision of you know, I'm a young single person about starting a family in Vermont. I'm a little bit more against it. It's a little tougher than if I were to be working back at a big corporate engineering firm, and so I think this is an important issue.
So, Rob, I'm sorry. Let me unpack this a little bit. You left a big company for a small company which doesn't offer benefits, a suite of benefits as generous as your former employer, correct?
Right, that's correct. Yeah,
and the idea that anybody should come along in the form of legislation and say that this small employer you're working with now should try to participate in a benefits package that's more generous and maybe more in line with what your former employer offered. You don't like that idea.
Oh, I absolutely do. I like that idea, but I think it's just tough. It's tough to compete with, you know, the big corporate, you know, national firms, especially in the engineering field.
Robin, and I think this, you know, it speaks exactly to why the legislature has been advancing this policy, is that it makes this viable for small businesses to have their employees covered by such a benefit. It's very easy for the IBMs or now Global Foundries of the world who have such large scale to offer a rich suite of benefits to their employees. It's very difficult for the very smallest small businesses in Vermont to do so. By creating a statewide paid leave program, we're actually taking that choice and the financial impact right out of their hands and putting it into a statewide program. so that every employee benefits, whether they work for a large firm, small firm, and whether they transfer between them.
All right, let's shift gears here a little bit and go to another issue, which I believe there was a, if I recall correctly, there was a gubernatorial veto, and we're going to find out a little bit about what's going to happen with this one, and that is another round of gun legislation. Tim Ash, start us off on this one.
Well, as you know, 2 years ago, we passed the first gun safety legislation in Vermont's history of any real import, and we did that with the legislature and the governor working in tandem on that. This past year, the legislature passed a law which would do a few things. It would create a 24-hour waiting period for handgun purchases. It would close the so-called Charleston loophole, which is the gap in our national background check law, which allows people to purchase weapons if the background check hasn't successfully gone through the National Register in the course of 3 days. That's how the fella in Charleston shot up the church. And we made some updates to the so-called red flag law, the Extreme Risk Protection Order. Both the House and Senate passed that legislation. The governor vetoed it. His veto message was a little unclear quite why. There was some suggestion that the data on a 24-hour waiting period is not rich enough to suggest its potential impact on saving lives. And that in some ways is true because Vermont, in an attempt to work with the governor, had gone with a fairly modest waiting period. Most states that have them range from 2 days to 5 days or even more. So the Speaker and I have been talking about this. We're trying to figure out what path to go forward. It doesn't look like we have the votes for a full override. So we do want to make progress, especially on the Charleston loophole, in closing that, updating the Extreme Risk Protection Order to make sure more people are protected in moments of crisis. And there are some important updates to consider to protect victims of domestic violence who are particularly vulnerable to gun violence in the immediate aftermath of domestic violence situations. So precisely how we go forward, I'm not sure at the moment, but those are the kind of priority threads.
Is your expectation right now that you are closer to a veto override majority in the Senate than exists in the House?
Well, the numbers, just like the a bit of the reverse of the medical monitoring law, we had 20 or 21 votes on the gun safety bill. The mm-hmm. House, and the Speaker can correct me, was somewhere in the mid-80s. So that's why, it's not a particularly rich discussion to talk about overriding the governor's veto on that bill, but rather what's the alternate path to do some important gun safety improvements.
What's your read on all that, Madam Speaker?
I concur with everything that the pro tem said, that I think we do still have more work to do. There was a recent report indicating that in terms of rates of death by firearm in domestic violence situations, Vermont ranks very high. And so we want to take steps to protect the specific area of gun violence where we do have the numbers to say that, yes, we got to work on this area. And we hope to talk with the governor, and see what we can move forward. I think closing the Charleston loophole is another critical piece that I have not heard a lot of pushback around. Most people think that to purchase a gun, you have to pass a background check, and as Senator Ash explained, you only have to not fail a background check in 3 days.
Wow. I didn't realize that. So there's sort of a default position that you get the gun.
Yes.
That's interesting.
And the people that tend to fall in that questionable, hold on, we got to look into this a little bit more, are people that, we need to think about public safety elements of giving a gun to. So I think just a standard saying in order to buy a gun, you have to pass a background check, period, is very reasonable.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it sounds like the strategy here may be to kind of pull this apart into pieces and try to work at them as separate pieces of the legislation in and of themselves, would you say, Madam Speaker?
I'm not sure. We've got to we've got to look because some of them are interrelated when you think about background checks and the kind of information available on a background check and how Vermont law interacts with that. So
yeah,
So I think we will look at that and we'll try to get a little more clarity from the governor's veto message about, you know, exactly what he meant. It wasn't a clear no. I mean, clearly it was a veto.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a clear statement of I don't like waiting periods. There was some fuzziness there, and if there's some common ground, we'd like to find it.
All right. Well, hey, we are needing to go to a bottom of the hour news break for CBS News Minute and a couple words from our sponsors. We'll be back in a couple of minutes here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM with our guests, House Speaker Mitzi Johnson and Senator Tim Ash, the President Pro Tem of the Vermont Senate, previewing the upcoming legislative session. We'll be back for more in a couple of minutes, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, continuing into our second hour. My guests are Tim Ash, the Senate President Pro Tem, and House Speaker Mitzi Johnson, both Democrats. They are in charge of the two bodies of the legislature. Of course, they get a lot of help and a lot of pushback sometimes when they exercise that leadership. But that's the nature of the game in the under the Golden Dome in Vermont, or probably most other places when you have a legislative process going on. And we have a bunch of sort of a priority list of stuff that is going to be up for debate here in the House and Senate this coming session, the second half of this biennium, I wanted to also mention, by the way, listeners, you are more than welcome to chime in here if you want to get a word in edgewise with your legislative leaders. That is 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And boy, all I have to do is mention listener calls and a couple pop into the system right off the bat. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dave, and Happy New Year to you and your guests.
And to you.
Hey, with regards to the gun legislation, I'm kind of ambivalent. I'm a gun owner, but I certainly understand some restrictions being placed for certain reasons. The comment or the conversation about the, I think it was a Charleston
loophole. Yep.
It confused me, and it seemed to me what you're saying, and if I get this wrong, please explain to me why it's wrong. It sounds to me like in this country where rule of law states that you're innocent or proven guilty, that you're kind of flipping that on its head. It's now it seems to me instead of you having to prove that I am not qualified to have a gun, it's up to me to prove my innocence and to the fact that I am, you know, capable of owning a gun with whatever restrictions that you've been, you know, you want to place on people who shouldn't have them. And that kind of flips the innocent until proven guilty on its head, at least in my mind. Am I reading wrong?
Tim Ash is giving me a signal that he wants to take a swing at this, so go ahead, Senator.
Well, you know, there is a national law requiring that all licensed firearm dealers run the potential purchaser's name through a national background check system. And so that is basically attempt to promote public safety. And like yourself, you know, gun owners all across the country have lived with that system for many, many years. It has not restricted people's right to exercise their constitutional rights. And what the Charleston loophole does, and this was an attempt, I believe, by certain advocacy organizations, they did not want people to walk into gun stores and not be able to walk out with a firearm because of some mismanaged federal bureaucracy that ran the system. So what they said is, after 3 days, if the check hasn't come through one way or the other, the firearm dealer has the option to sell it to the person who'd like to buy it. So in some ways, that leaves this choice up to the seller of the firearm, who doesn't know if the person's on the list or not. What closing the Charleston loophole does is says that the same background check that every gun purchaser has gone through for many years has to conclude the process before the gun is transferred to the buyer. Most instances, it's almost instantaneous. It's a very rare occasion where it might take up to 3 days. In fact, we hear it almost never happens in Vermont through any of the licensed firearm dealers. So we think of this as just closing an inadvertent gap in public safety. It shouldn't affect very many at all legal gun purchasers, and it will make sure that we don't inadvertently allow some individuals to purchase firearms when they're actually on a national list saying they can't buy it.
Okay, so it's about the length of time in terms of trying to determine whether that person is qualifies to.
That's exactly right.
Let me bring in Speaker Mitzi Johnson and ask you, Madam Speaker, do you think that the that this is a wise, the closing the Charleston loophole in the manner that Senator Ash was just talking about, is that the way to go here?
Yes, I fully support it. I think just making sure that the background system, the national information system, has a chance to do its job is important in this.
But let me give you a couple devil's advocate questions, or at least one. Senator Ash was talking a moment ago about putting pressure on the federal government to make sure it runs a tight system and that it's not a bureaucratic nightmare, blah, blah, blah. Suppose the government system breaks down and it turns out it's taking, 60 days or something to get some of these, there are horror stories that start making the media about, I wanted to buy a hunting rifle and by the time I got my clearance, it was after hunting season or something. What would we do with that?
Well, I think that's really.
I was going to ask Speaker Johnson that one first.
I think that's a situation that I have never heard of happening. So in that case, we look at whether there is some sort of emergency procedure that needs to happen. It is still national law that some sort of background check needs to happen. And so we don't have the authority to just say, nope, we're not going to do any background checks. And I don't think that's an appropriate thing to do either. I don't know of any situation under which something like that would or could happen. So dealing with the history that we have with the background check system and the very, very, very small percentage of people that don't get an immediate answer, I think it's a wise move.
Okay. Senator Ash, you were going to say something.
Well, bear in mind that the individuals who would be ineligible to purchase are people who a court has deemed that their mental health makes them ineligible to possess or purchase a firearm, and the same goes for convicted felons. So the sort of doomsday scenario, which some people maybe feared when this law was passed in the first place, there is no realistic prospect that would come to be, and we have to balance the very purpose of the law is to keep firearms out of the hands of dangerous people who might hurt themselves or others.
Let's go to caller Chris from Waterbury. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning, Dave.
How are you doing?
Good. Happy New Year to your guests.
And to you as well.
Well, it's become apparent to me that a lot of the legislation that's taking place up at the State House bears little logic. You've got paid family leave, you've got health care issues, you've got imposing minimum wage, the carbon tax, all these things that are going to require more tax dollars. And it doesn't seem as though that you're moving the goalposts much as far as making it more affordable for people in this state to live here. You got the substance abuse problems that are in the state. Now you're introducing more legislation to allow more substance abuse. the definition of recreational marijuana is nothing more than a full-time right to smoke marijuana. And you see it I speak to a lot of self-employed people who deal with the repercussions of those types of things all the time. Our workforce is becoming more distracted during the day due to either cell phone use or substance abuse problems. If you look at the benefits that you gain from allowing or, I guess, not dealing with these types of issues versus the repercussions, the cost that it costs the taxpayers in the state to deal with all these problems, incarceration issues, judicial issues, rehabilitation issues, impacts to employers, impacts to families.
Yep. Chris, we got to get to sort of a punctuation mark here.
Yep.
So your point is,
as far as the gun control laws, I understand what's going on. You're picking away at small portions of our gun rights, and the eventual goal, I believe, is to eliminate all gun laws, all guns in the state of Vermont moving forward. So, have a good New Year, everyone.
All right, thanks for the call, Chris. Anything you want to tackle there, Senator Ash?
Well, I don't believe we're trying to pick away at gun rights with an intent of removing firearms from individuals in Vermont across the board. Those who have a particularly ideologically rigid approach to gun ownership might feel that way, but that is not the reality, and that's why the vast majority of Vermonters support the measures the legislature has been putting forward.
He did mention another issue that I wanted to get to before time slips away here. I guess I could say he referred to it, or maybe referred to it, and that was marijuana. Bad pun, sorry.
You're the boss, Dave. You can get away with it, I guess.
And I'm just wondering, are we going to go to a retail tax and regulate kind of a system in this upcoming legislative session? I'll start with you, Madam Speaker.
So we've had House committees working on this bill ever since we got it from the Senate in April or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's passed out of the House Government Operations Committee. With some changes, it's currently being worked on in the House Ways and Means Committee, and I have long said that we need to make sure that we are carefully addressing issues of prevention, youth usage, and road safety, and some environmental impacts of large growers. And there are it's been a really interesting discussion because, you know, there are people that have wanted a tax and regulate system for a long time that have been really working for that and advocating for it and are still doing so. But some of the interesting conversations for me are people that were very much in favor of marijuana legalization and now are pushing the pause button saying, okay, it's where we want it right now. We're sort of in this gray area. We're in a little bit of don't ask, don't tell. You can own it. You just can't buy it or sell it. So anybody that has possession, is assumed to have grown it, and which is clearly not the case.
So we have
there are some other people who were very much opposed to legalization who have said, okay, now we're in the worst possible situation. So if we lost the discussion on legalization, now we have to move to tax and regulate.
It's a weird position that Vermont is in. It's in a sort of limbo where, in fact, from what I understand, there's some aspects of the law that literally don't really add up because you can grow more than you could possess, right? If you have, I don't remember the exact number of plants, but you can end up with a plant that an individual marijuana plant or cannabis plant can produce, say, a pound if you have a green thumb. You could get a pound of cannabis off of one plant. And that's way beyond the possession limit of 1 ounce. So now what do you do?
Well, your knowledge of these issues, Dave, we'll just assume you've been reading about them. The law did, when it passed.
We're listening to radio programming.
That's true. Yeah, the law, when it passed, assumed that people could, the plants might produce more than otherwise one could possess in public, has requirements about keeping it in a safe place and stored on site and not being sold illegally, because currently that would be illegal. So the law assumed some of those bumpy transitions, I'll describe them as. And as the speaker says, we're in this gray zone where people are growing for themselves. Black market continues, gray market continues. And the question is whether we will benefit from a regulated system where people know what they're getting, and we can get some of the revenues, which would help support the kind of issues the speaker suggested we need in terms of prevention, roadside safety, and so on. So the legislature in general is moving in that direction. I know the governor has said it's a matter of when, not if. And so we still have work to do to get to these last, policy question marks resolved. It does seem we're moving there. We've just seen another community vote not to allow retail sales. I believe it was Thetford. And so I think communities are starting to, adjust and make decisions about whether they want their community to be participating in this market or not.
One of the interesting aspects of this, when we talk about roadside safety, is that we don't really have a very accurate test, from what I understand, useful test for determining whether someone is actually impaired by cannabis while driving. And I'm wondering, do you expect that that the instances of people who are driving while impaired by cannabis would go up or down or sort of sideways? Because people are doing it now, I think would they increase, decrease, or remain roughly static if we made some kind of a change where cannabis were for sale, say, as a little section of the state liquor store or something?
Well, it's tough to know it precisely. I know that the analysis that was done for the legislature several years ago projected that 80,000 Vermonters are using marijuana products at least once a month. Mm-hmm. So your point that people are already on the road, presumably with THC in their bloodstream, makes perfect sense. We know that people drive when they shouldn't on not just marijuana, but other substances, including alcohol. And so the real question is, in a regulated market with a comprehensive approach to education and prevention, will it make the problem better, worse, or stay the same? And we believe that the tools to educate people about the impact of marijuana on their driving ability probably goes up, because we have the revenues to help support a campaign educating people about that.
Let's go to a caller. Ruth from Sheldon's on the line. Good morning, Ruth. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. I see a Vermont, the state that I love, dying. And if you think that paid family leave and raising the minimum wage isn't going to hurt small businesses, if you think it's going to help small businesses, you are very wrong. If you destroy the small businesses that are left in Vermont, you're putting the final nail in the coffin. I'm very serious about this. All the things that you are doing are hurting the people of Vermont, and you need to listen to what we are saying. You drove our business out of business by over-regulating it, and I don't want to get into that, but we can't afford to lose any more small businesses.
Ruth, let me ask you about listening to the people, because you're talking to a couple of legislators here, each of whom has been reelected several times, and I think the people who vote for them generally know which way their politics lean and so on and so forth. Why are the people of Vermont not being listened to? We have this democratic process called elections every 2 years.
Beats me. I guess there's more people who benefit by the giveaway programs that the Democrats have than there are working people who are working to support these programs.
So it's all just a matter of bribing the voters, as opposed to the voters actually having any reasonable views on stuff that where they say, I actually think some of these ideas are good.
Well, it sounds like you don't want to listen to me either. So I will
just
hang
question.
Up now. No, I'll just hang up.
Okay.
Because you're always right, Dave. You're always right, and I'm always wrong.
Thank you for the call, Ruth. Have a happy new year. Let's go to, I think next was Jerry in Berlin. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
Happy new year.
And to you.
I have a couple of questions. One is there was a gentleman a couple calls before that was talking about the legalization of marijuana. And I want to really ask him if he went, does he go to a bar or does he drink at home? Does he drink alcohol? Because my opinion is out the state runs the sale of alcohol in the state of Vermont.
Yes.
And they tax it and they regulate it. So this, you know what, I'm going to tell you something. When I was about, I'm 64 years old.
Mm-hmm.
When I was about, 18, I found a thing in the Times Argus. It was a full page ad. And it said, if dad can have his drink, then why can't Junior smoke his pot? That was...
You're talking about like having wine in church or something?
Well, just, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going there.
Yeah.
I mean, we could talk about prohibition. How did that work in the United States?
Gave a big boost to organized crime. Hey, Jerry, I got to get another caller in.
And the other thing is, there's a reason why people are getting voted in. They're incumbents.
Thank you for the call. Yep. Hey, let's go to Dean from Waitsville. Good morning, Dean.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes.
I was wanted to comment on, since marijuana has been legalized, I guess traffic deaths have gone down 35%. Now, I'm sure if it was the opposite, you guys would be screaming and yelling about how pot is bad for
road safety.
Highway. Yeah.
You know, you make a really good point, because I was asking about this a couple of weeks ago, saying, how is it that there's all this concern about road safety in connection with marijuana? And since July of 2018... and frankly, I think it's probably just a coincidence or something. I've never thought there was a huge correlation here either way. But it is fascinating to me that with all the talk about road safety and marijuana, you know, since we have this sort of semi-demi, whatever, legalization in Vermont, not total retail, but, you know, people can possess it up to an ounce, we've seen our traffic fatalities plummet. And if you look at the figures from the state police, and I'm just wondering, you know, I don't hear a lot of chatter from the anti-pot people anymore about, you know, carnage on the highways. What about you, Speaker Johnson? Is that as big a concern, or is it waning given this experience?
You know, Vermont is fortunate to have very low numbers of highway deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have... I'm just cautious about making blanket statements that say this relates to and is caused by this.
Well, so am I.
You know, you have a situation where there's an awful situation where a number of people are killed at once for some reason, and that is enough in Vermont to skew percentages of traffic deaths significantly.
Right. Yes.
So I fully agree that we were dealing long before legalization, dealing with people impaired by all sorts of legal and illegal substances on the road. A much bigger problem with traffic safety is just distraction. You know, people on their phones doing too many things, going down the road with an electric razor, their mascara brush. You know, you see all kinds of stuff.
You'll like this. I remember a few years ago, the AP had a story. Actually, they found a case in Maryland where a flutist was on her way to a performance, a concert or something, and actually had the sheet music across the steering wheel and was practicing her flute while she's driving down the beltway or something. And anyway, and then I've seen those posts on Facebook where you have a police officer in his cruiser, and he's got computers around him and cell phones and radios and all this other stuff. And, you know, the captain just says distracted driving, question mark. So, yeah. I get it.
But it remains, it remains an issue. And with alcohol, there is a reliable test, and there is, at this point, a lot of public education about how much is too much. And without that same correlation, and because alcohol is processed in a very different way and metabolized in a very different way in your body, mm-hmm. than THC, the active ingredient in marijuana is, there is something a little more predictable about how much you can drink and when, and still drive safely.
Yeah.
And so all of those things are a whole lot hazier, so to speak, with pot. By further normalizing it and making it a little more mainstream, not that it isn't already with the numbers, we want to make sure that there is an awful lot of public education, that there are ways to deal with this. We have put in the last number of years, we have expanded the number of drug recognition experts because, as you mentioned, there is not a reliable roadside test for impairment. You know, it can test presence, but because of the way it is metabolized and stored in your body very differently than alcohol, presence does not indicate impairment. So it all gets very tricky.
Very tricky. You guys have a lot of tricky things to deal with as in your work as legislators. Legislators, when they're in session from January to May, tend to work long hours of trying to unravel a lot of Vermont's problems. I think it's all worthy of admiration from the public, even if you don't always agree with what they do. Bottom line. All right. Hey, I'm going to thank my guests very much. They have been Mitzi Johnson, the Speaker of the House, Democratic House member from the Champlain Islands, and Tim Ashley, Senate President pro tem. Thank you both very much for joining me on the air this morning. Good conversation.
Thanks, Dave.
All right. Are going to go to a top of the hour CBS News break here on the Dave Graham Show. We'll be back with more to follow.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can't stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, continuing into our second hour of this January 2nd, 2020. Thursday morning program here on the Dave Graham Show. So glad to have you staying with us, listeners out there. And we have Bill Rakoff on the line. He is with CBS News, and he's going to fill us in a little bit about what's going on down there in the big nation's capital, or the nation's big capital, or whatever it is. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Thanks again for having me. Happy New Year.
Glad to welcome you to the program here, and Happy New Year to you as well. So tell me a little bit about tomorrow. It looks like the Senate comes back into session, and then they've got this little impeachment thing maybe on their plate, or maybe not quite there, or what the heck's going on?
Well, they'll come back tomorrow, and they're going to try and get some business out of the road. But yes, first and foremost on everybody's mind is, what will the Senate do with impeachment? We've been on a holiday break now. They've been meeting in pro forma session, which means both the House and the Senate occasionally will gavel in for a couple of minutes just to make sure there aren't any huge things that have popped up that they need to deal with, and then they clock right back out again. They just did it in the House a couple of minutes ago, as a matter of fact. So we're waiting to see what Mitch McConnell will do. He's under pressure from both sides of his party although it's kind of shifting ground. So you've got the one side that says, let's get this thing over with, Senator Lindsey Graham leading that charge, saying, let's get in here, let's just get it done, let's vote it down, because it was just the worst handled thing in the House, and there's nothing to it. And then you've got the others, and the president has often dipped his toe into this water, is to say, well, what if we did drag it out? What if we did bring the whistleblower in? What if we did call witnesses? Wouldn't it be nice to have the whistleblower come in and once and for all clear things up? Now, Mitch McConnell is in the decidedly let's get this over with camp, but at the same time, he wants to be respectful of the process above all, and knows that he's got to handle this delicately one way or the other. So the long way around to your answer is nobody really knows what's happening yet, and tomorrow may be the very first signs of where we may get some indication of how the winds are blowing here.
Of course, the other thing is that the House has not formally made the handoff yet either. Everybody's kind of looking at the Senate, but suppose the House suddenly said, hey, let's just put this thing on hold. We'll put them on the shelf for some length of time and continue with our business of calling in, of inviting the president, telling the president, you want to speed it up? Send us Mulvaney, send us Pompeo, send us Giuliani, these other witnesses we've been asking for months. Send us the documents we've been asking for months. And if you do want to get this thing over with, let's get the process moving, stop battling us at every step of the way in court and so on. Is there any talk of the House possibly, saying, we're going to remain kind of in the driver's seat here for a while?
Well, there's some talk about it, but we're not getting any indication that that's going to happen from the Speaker's office. That would be really politically fraught, because what you're doing is essentially feeding the Republican narrative that, look, you guys have screwed this up all the way along, meaning the Democrats. The Republicans say you didn't have a great case, when you named your impeachment inquiry, and they always say that was not done correctly because it wasn't done on a floor vote. They did do a floor vote, and then they finally got it done, but Republicans said you're still not doing it good enough because you're not calling the witnesses, you're not waiting for the court decisions, you're jamming this thing through because you're on a political clock because of the 2020 campaign. You guys want to get this thing over and done with. If Democrats were to suddenly pull back the cards and say, you know what, let's wait for a couple of these court cases to resolve, boy, are you ever giving ammunition to the Republicans there in terms of saying, see, we told you so, you don't have anything, and now you're trying to wait for something.
Could the Democrats respond to that, though, by just saying, hey, you guys told us this case was thin and that we've rushed it, so we're going to slow it down and thicken it up.
Nobody in Washington likes to lose a case if I told you so.
All right, okay.
And that's the bottom line here. So, but it's not that it's never happened before. It certainly has.
I think it would be.
I just don't see, Dave, how they hold it up too long. They may hold it a little bit while they're circling the wagons and trying to get their things together, but don't for a minute think they haven't been working on that over the break.
I have heard some chatter of possible additional articles of impeachment, though. Is that at all possible?
Well, I mean, they could do that, and that could be independent of what we're doing now, right? So, I mean, you submit these articles of impeachment over, and you play the hand that you're dealt and find out what happens in the Senate. Now, we pretty much understand what we think is going to happen in the Senate. We don't expect a whole lot of Republican defections, and we expect that the president, if it's a party-line thing, will be acquitted on these charges. Now, could the House start another investigation and come back with further articles of impeachment anytime they want? So, whether they do that in conjunction with what's going on now, let this play out and give it a try again. But again, Nancy Pelosi, she's just between a rock and a hard place on this, because she all along has resisted this urge for impeachment, but had to give in to it at this point. She would much rather her members be able to focus on legislative achievement as they're going up for re-election this year, as opposed to having to run against President Trump. And if there's more investigation, more impeachment talk, that's going to suck up the oxygen here. And it's going to make it harder, she thinks, and a lot of others, too, for Democrats to be able to hold on to some of those, middle-of-the-road seats.
Or could it be, though, that they're already off the diving board, so why not just go for it?
There's that. That's a fair statement. I mean, the articles of impeachment have been approved by the House, by the House. And normally what has happened in the past is day of, those things get marched across the Capitol to the Senate, where they are received. And as you might know, there's also some argument, is he really impeached until the Senate has it in their hand? So there's some talk about that as well. But I think it's fair to say that they have taken the dive at this point, and they need to see how the landing, whether they stick it or not, and you know whether they add anything to it down the line or come back with something more. That's just a wait and see game. 2020 is wide open right now in terms of what's going to happen in this process. But I do think that at least as it pertains to this particular impeachment process, I think there's a great sense among both Republicans and Democrats. Let's get this over with, say, before, if we can't get it done before the Iowa caucuses, let's really try to get it done before March when all the primaries and the campaigning for re-election gets underway in the House.
So let me ask you one last crazy question, which is about voir dire and jury selection. This thing is supposed to be court-like. They call in the Chief Justice. These people take an oath saying we're going to do equal or impartial justice. You know, you've already got Lindsey Graham and Leader McConnell out there, making statements basically saying this is a slam dunk. Here's how we're going to do this before they even hear any evidence. You know, if I were called to jury duty down at my local courthouse here and I wanted to get off of it, the first thing I would do is hold a press conference on the front steps of the courthouse and talk about what a terrible job the prosecution is doing. Sort of like what the Republicans did when they filed that resolution way back in October saying that the House is messing up on its pursuit of this impeachment inquiry. Why is nobody raising this issue of how can we develop an impartial jury here?
Oh, they are raising it, but they're raising it against, you know, the inevitability of what's likely to happen over there in the Senate. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are saying that Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham are just saying out loud what happens all the time, even in past impeachments. You know, they stuck fairly close to party lines in the impeachment of Bill Clinton. It was lining up that way for Richard Nixon. If you want to go back to Andrew Johnson, which I haven't, you know, gotten into, I'm sure it was a bit of the same. So, I mean, what everybody's saying is they're clasping their and clutching their pearls over politics. And why should that be a surprise that that infiltrates what's going on here?
Politics going on here? Oh, my word.
I'm just saying. But what you count on here is you count on the cool and even hand of the Chief Justice of the United States. William Rehnquist did that in the Clinton impeachment, and he saw himself not so much as somebody who was intervening, but somebody who was presiding and somebody who was handling the requests as they came. He didn't try to direct it. Whether John Roberts sees it that way or not, we'll have to see, but that's what it lies on. When you have people coming out and openly saying, look, you know, we're working with the president on this, it's politics, nobody should be surprised. And while Democrats are getting all upset about that, you've got the one guy who is going to try to keep everybody between the double yellow lines here, and that's John Roberts. So he is the key factor here to watch.
And good luck to him.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Bill Rakoff, I really thank you for joining me this morning. It's always good chatting with you.
Absolutely. Take care.
We'll talk soon. Going to be talking this next segment of the program here this morning about a shipment of hemp from Vermont to New York, which went wrong, I guess is the best way to describe it. Of course, Vermont had quite a burgeoning hemp harvest season this fall, and I think it was November 2nd that a man by the name of Ronan Levy in New York City was asked by his brother, who was having a medical issue, hey, brother, can you go and pick up my load of hemp that I'm just getting delivered from Vermont for use in my CDB manufacturing facility and shop there in Brooklyn, New York? And that was Oren Levy, who owns Green Angel CBD, said to his brother, please go pick this up for me. I've got to go to the doctor or the hospital or something. And Ronan Levy went and picked up this shipment. The shipment was being picked up at the 75th precinct of the New York City Police. They had called and said, your shipment of hemp is here. And because there is always, or it seems to be, maybe this will wane over time, but some concern when people ship hemp, the question arises, it looks a lot like, smells a lot like cannabis. Cannabis, of course, is still illegal in a lot of places, and so therefore you might draw some law enforcement interest. This material was not cannabis. It was hemp. It had a THC level low enough to qualify as hemp, and even had paperwork produced it by the producers in Vermont that it was a low THC hemp and not cannabis. And that had been cleared by the Williston Police Department as it was being shipped by FedEx down to New York City. And the Williston Police Department gave it the thumbs up and go ahead and ship your hemp to New York. You're okay. You're within the law. And when it got to New York, the New York Police Department, NYPD, apparently had a different idea about all of this and ended up arresting Ronan Levy, when he went to pick up his cannabis. All of this in early November. The Levy brothers, Ronan and Oren, are now have told the city they plan on suing the NYPD and the city of New York. And so we're going to get an update on this case. It's kind of an interesting, fascinating aspect of the burgeoning young hemp industry in Vermont and in the United States. And I believe I've got Ronan Levy on the line here from New York this morning. Are you there, Mr. Levy?
Yes, sir. How are you? Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year to you as well. Thanks for joining me on the program this morning. I'm going to keep you on just to let you know until about 20 of 11, and then I'm going to let you go, and we're going to bring in Jehala Dudley, the farmer in Vermont who actually shipped the hemp down to New York that ended up being a little bit of trouble for you when you went to pick it up. So tell me the story. It's November 2nd. Your brother says, hey, I'm sick. Can you go pick up my hemp for me, right?
A little bit like that. So November 2nd, my brother was already, he already went into the hospital. He had an emergency appendicitis. I believe it was that Wednesday or Thursday, right before November 2nd.
Okay.
And he had the shipment already scheduled to come down, and they were getting it packed in Vermont and all getting ready. So he asked me if I could go pick it up for him on Saturday, which I had no problem. I had nothing better to do. So I agreed, and so we were talking during that day and that Friday and that Saturday. And November 2nd, I did get a phone call from the Vermont Police Department, and very nice guy that was on the phone, and told me, you know, my shipment got flagged by FedEx, and they gave it a thumbs up and it should be there shortly and so on and so forth. And, you know, I thanked him, and he was a very nice guy, and my day went on the way. I called my brother and I explained to him. He said, yep, I got the same phone call. And that was that. A little bit later, my brother said, he called me back. He said the FedEx driver actually flagged it again in Brooklyn. I don't think the 75th precinct actually took over. I think they got flagged before by the same driver again.
I see.
And then the 75th precinct got the shipment. And I got a phone call around 2 o'clock or so from the arresting officer saying that everything was okay with the shipment. They checked my paperwork and so on and so forth. And you're more than welcome to come down and pick it up. And, you know, meanwhile, I was, you know, always in contact with my brother, letting him know what was going on. And I said I was going to go down and pick it up. And the officer said to be there before 7 o'clock. And that kind of drew a little suspicion, but I thought maybe, you know, he was getting off work or whatnot. And being that it was already flagged by the Vermont Police Department, I had nothing really to be scared of. So I told my brother, okay, I'm going to go pick it up. When I got there, I was greeted by the arresting officer and a plainclothes detective, I believe Stephen Bannerman or something like that. And they asked me for my ID and said they were going to go proceed with the paperwork and then I'll be ready to sign it. But they want to ask me a couple of questions, what was, you know, about the shipment, what we did with it, which again didn't strike anything wrong. But when they told me to come upstairs to the questioning room, something didn't feel right.
Hmm. Was there any moment during this process when you said to yourself, I wonder if I should call my lawyer?
Yes. So actually at that moment, before I actually went up, my friend was with me. He drove down with me in my van because I was expecting to pick up the 9 boxes. I didn't really want to do it by myself.
Yeah.
But before I went in, I actually did tell him, here's my brother's number just in case something happens. And he was the same way. He was like, I don't think anything's going to happen. I said, look, just in case. You don't know.
Yeah.
I don't
want
you out here with my van and you just stuck out here in Brooklyn and East New York and you don't know what's going on. And lo and behold, you know, my suspicions, that little trigger just, you know, triggered off. And when I was upstairs, I already knew something was happening. They didn't actually tell me I was getting arrested yet. They were trying to fish some questions out of me before they arrested me. They sat me down. They told me they're going to start recording me. And I don't think that was a really good idea for them to record me, because if that recording ever comes up, you'll find how uneducated they are with the hemp laws, because they had no clue the amount of level of THC allowed in hemp. They were just going by that field test kit that they have.
Yeah,
and they didn't want it. They didn't listen to me. They didn't care. They didn't care that hemp had trace elements of THC and that it will test positive in your faulty $2 test kits.
Do you recall what the percentage is if it's hemp, and what the percentage of THC in the plant is if it's considered? I mean, what's typical in the commercial?
I believe anything. I believe hemp is 0.03.
Okay.
Below that is hemp.
Yeah.
Anything above that will be considered illegal.
And hemp growers, the farmers who were growing this and who were trying to sort of build this hemp industry, tend to be, from my understanding, pretty careful about testing their crops and making sure that they stay under that limit. And I believe some testing actually happened at Fox Holler Farm up here in New Haven, Vermont, before this hemp even went, before it was even shipped via FedEx. Right.
Yes. Yeah. All the test analysis were inside the boxes, along with legal documents showing the farm's business and license, I believe, from the Department of Agriculture.
Yep.
And also another letter stating that if the shipment ever got seized or flagged, that they should call this number, and the other number they could verify the shipment.
Right. And so the FedEx driver picks this up, apparently has concerns right off the bat. Maybe the FedEx driver needs to be a little bit better educated about the hemp laws, too, because I guess he or she stops in Williston, which I guess that's where the FedEx terminal is up here, and goes to the Williston police and says, you want to check this out? And they check it out and they give it a green light.
Right. Well, here's the weird part. I don't know exactly what was going on in the driver's mind, but, if you're going to a Fox Holler Farms and, you're going to a farm, you're not going to be picking up, something. I'm sure the farm says hemp farms on there because they're not a THC farm. So
yeah,
that right off the bat, I'm sure the FedEx driver knew where he was getting his stuff from.
Mm-hmm.
But after it got flagged, he already knew without a doubt that was hemp and it was legal. So when he left there, I don't understand what went through his mind or why he did what he did and reflagged it in Brooklyn, because there was no reason for him to do that. I guess that will come up later in court when our suit gets involved and with that. But I really don't understand what they did or what even happened to our paperwork from the Vermont Police Department when they told everything was on the thumbs up to the 75th precinct.
Are you saying some paperwork disappeared somewhere between Vermont and New York?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The paperwork disappeared inside our boxes. It was never presented to the DA. It was never presented inside the boxes. I got the shipment. This is the kicker. I went to go pick up the shipment on Monday last week, I believe, and inside the evidence bags, the way they seal it, they seal the box and then they seal the hemp separately. And one box was actually sealed with the Vermont farm paper. So they stated that there were no papers in the boxes. So then how did you guys seal the paperwork inside your evidence bag?
Yeah, that would be an interesting question to find out and of course you guys are going to be going to court on this in a suit against the city. I guess the criminal charges now have been dropped, right?
Criminal charges have been dropped. The hemp has been returned. The other thing I forgot to mention to you, right before I did get arrested, so the officer called me at 2:02, but at 1:43 p.m., he actually received an email from Fox Holler Farms, again, with all the paperwork and my brother's ID and everything.
Yeah. So the farmers already suspecting that we may have a problem with the NYPD here, and they are sending this email down to say, hey, by the way, NYPD, here's all the paperwork that is connected with this shipment. Here's the ID of the person that we were shipping it to. I guess you're now dealing with his brother because this person has come down ill. But that's the story. And yep. you know, here you go. Now, the first time this came to public notice, from what I can tell, is that the NYPD officers involved actually posted a big picture to Facebook, and they were very proudly standing behind what looked like a couple of cafeteria tables loaded up with bags of dark green leafy material that, to the naked eye, looks like it could be either hemp or cannabis, right?
Oh, yeah. They were very proud of it.
Yeah. And by the way, for those who are unfamiliar with this stuff, the smell isn't much different either. I mean, there is quite an aroma to fresh either one of these crops. And I just know this because I've known people. I knew someone this past summer who worked on a hemp farm. here in Vermont as part, you know, in the big harvest season. They were hiring tons of young people to go out there and harvest the hemp. And I remember this person, I ran into them, you know, one early evening after work. They just got off work, and I took a whiff, and I said, wow.
Yeah.
I said, wow. You know.
Nice aroma.
And you know, he says, that's just hemp. I was working on the hemp farm all day, and I said, yeah, I believe it. You know, because it's a related enough plant that you might expect the look and the aroma would be very similar. So there you go.
Yeah. So it's funny because there's a video of me on my YouTube about me picking up the hemp. Asking the officer if they could give me some paperwork when I go home, because I didn't want to get rearrested for driving with this hemp in my truck, because the thing had a lot of smell and it was actually coming out of the back of the truck. So they didn't really have paperwork for me, but they actually made a photocopy of what I was taking home, so this way I don't get in trouble. For some reason, falsely arrested. I don't know why. It does have a great smell to it. And I can understand, where people could get confused. I don't know if this was really a confusion, because, you know, from leaving the Vermont Police Department, they already knew it was hemp. So,
yeah. Well, and I guess as part of police training here, because, you know, I don't want to see NYPD officers wasting their time and their energy and their,
right,
and their Facebook posting time and all the rest of it. So they clearly need some training to say, when you see a shipment like this, threshold question, is this hemp or is this cannabis? Okay, if it's cannabis, then the New York State cannabis laws come into play, right? And somebody may get busted, right? Yeah. If it's hemp, and then it's legal, and it's a different story. So it seems like that there would be a protocol for any New York City police precinct, maybe the 75th here, to say, you know, here, let's roll in our testing equipment, and we'll test it and see what we conclude about this, whether it's over or under 0.3%, et cetera. Hey, but Ronan Levy, I want to, we got to go to a bottom of the hour break for just 1 minute or CBS News, and then a word from our sponsors. And I want to keep you on the line, if you don't mind, and talk to you a little bit more on the other side. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
All right, we'll be right back with you and with our listeners here on the Dave Graham Show, WDEV, in just a few minutes.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot, and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back. My guest is Ronan Levy. He was arrested by New York City police on November 2nd when he went to pick up a load of hemp shipped from Vermont. It was destined for his brother. His brother was sick and said, hey, brother, can you go pick up my hemp for me? And Ronan went to go run this errand for his brother and ended up spending 33 hours incarcerated in the New York City lockup. And by the way, how did that go for you? It must be weird to spend that first night in jail in New York City.
Oh, boy. First time ever being in jail. It was definitely a horrible experience. Obviously I wasn't aware that I was getting arrested, so I wasn't dressed for the occasion. I had on a t-shirt, pair of jeans and sneakers, and it's freezing in jail. It's disgusting. Feces and urine all over the place, flies. And you get no attention whatsoever, basically. The first, up until 2 o'clock in the morning, I spent, in the precinct jail cell.
Mm-hmm.
And then they switched me over to transfer me to a central booking, which is not any better. It's actually worse, because that's where you stay with a bunch of people. All the people inside were actually very nice. But you know, everybody uses the same bathroom, and there is no water, and there's nothing to keep yourself warm, and you barely get any food. You got dry bread with cheese that comes in plastic packages that I actually use as a pillow. And you get dry cereal, and that was pretty good, but there was no water to wash it down with, and whatever water they did give you was pretty disgusting.
Yikes.
It wasn't, yeah, no bottled water or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't know if the in the cell, the toilet and the sinks are pretty much connected together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All in all, not a it's not the Ritz-Carlton. So
no. And then in Central Booking, they move you from place to place to place to place. They put you from different cell to a different cell to a different cell to a different cell about 8 times or 10 times. And then I went to see the judge, and we went to see, they didn't have no paperwork that was given that was supposed to be inside the boxes that were set me free at the time. They didn't even know that it was hemp. My legal aide looked at me like I was a nut because he was, you know, he said, you have 6 counts of felony charges. How are you going to plea? I said, not guilty the next day. And he looked at me like, not guilty. I'm like, yeah, not guilty. I'm not guilty. It's hemp. And the night before, I sent him all the literature that he needed, and he did a lot of research, and he presented that to the judge. The judge was unaware at the time as well, but they allowed me to go home, R&R, no bail, no money.
Yeah.
And that was the start of this whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So, and it sounds like the hemp didn't do much better in police custody.
No, I don't, you know, they did seal it up and store it. I just don't know exactly where it went. I know about 30 bags or so were opened and resealed for them to test to make sure everything was okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about it. As far as you know, what happened in the 2 months in between, I can't comment. I wasn't there. I don't know. I could only tell you what I knew from when I received it.
Yeah. So this whole experience here, it sounds like, is it worth it to you? Do you wish your brother and you were in a different business?
Is it worth it to me? Oh boy. I don't know. I guess this could happen to anybody doing any business. I guess if the NYPD won't follow the correct channels, if you must say, it goes with anything. Cause if they went the other direction and just said, okay, Ronan, we got your paperwork. We're going to hold you for 24 hours, but you're not arrested, or, you know, give us your name and your number. You know, don't go. We got to check this out and everything. You know, that would have went a different direction. But yeah, I don't know. I don't.
By the way, I just want to make clear to listeners, I did a little bit of due diligence here, and I actually emailed last night when I learned that you were going to be available, Ronan Levy, to be my guest on the program this morning. I said, well, you know, I was trying to get two sides of every story. So I emailed Officer Rodney Greenidge of the New York City Police to ask whether he might like to be a guest on this program this morning as well. And I said, and if not you, officer, perhaps you could, you know, put me in touch with your official public relations person or whoever it is you would have do a media interview. And I've not heard word one back from the NYPD from either Officer Greenidge or anyone else with the NYPD as of just now. I looked at my email over the break a few minutes ago and nothing yet in. And so just wanted to mention that because, you know, it is, as I say, it is important that folks know that I'm trying to get all perspectives here if I can. And speaking of getting all perspectives, I am actually going to wish Ronan Levy a happy new year and maybe a better 2020 than you had a 2019. No trips to jail in 2020, please. And yeah. I want to thank you very much for joining me on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV this morning. I'm going to jump off with you and actually see if we can get Jehala Dudley on the phone. She is the farmer at the Fox Holler Farm in New Haven, Vermont. Grew the hemp and started this shipment process. So we're going to be talking with her next. Ronan Levy, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, sir. You guys have a happy and a healthy New Year's, and I do appreciate you reaching out to us.
All righty, very good. We are now going to shift over to Jehala Dudley. She is, as I mentioned, the farmer proprietor. I'm not sure exactly what the title is at the Fox Holler Farm in New Haven, Vermont, and grew the hemp in question. Good morning, Jehala Dudley.
Hey, how are you guys?
I'm well. Thanks for so much for joining me here on the air on WDEV FM and AM over here in Waterbury, Vermont, on the other side of the Green Mountains. And Jehala Dudley, you told me that you had actually been doing business with the Levy brothers in New York for a while. This is not the first shipment you've sent them.
No, it was maybe the fourth shipment.
Okay.
We've had two, prior to that, we had two successful shipments with FedEx.
And were they all from this harvest season, or did you start this in like 2018?
No, they were all from 2019 harvest.
Okay. And you've been growing hemp there in New Haven for how long?
This was our first year in New Haven. I've grown it in various places before, but this was our first venture in New Haven, Vermont.
I see. Okay. And how many acres in hemp did you have this year?
We had 10 acres, and we have roughly 1,000 plants an acre.
Wow. So that's a pretty big operation there. I'm sure your harvest season was quite busy. And tell me a little bit about your, is this your main farming operation, or do you have other stuff you're doing, and this is a sideline, or how's that work?
Right now, this is the main thing because it's just taken over and it's taking a lot of time and it's enabled me to be a full-time position.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the cannabis industry in various ways for the last few years in policy out west in grows and in Vermont here at one of the medical dispensaries. So when I started getting into hemp, I got into hemp on the processing side, thinking about oils and concentrates, but the growing side and the agricultural aspect was really what I wanted to do. So I dove into it last year with my business partner, Buddy Kerner of Felino's Pizza, and here we are. It's fairly comparatively we've been okay. We've been fairly successful.
Well, I was going to say overall first year of growing hemp, are you happy with it?
Yeah. I'm not super psyched.
Uh-huh.
I'm content for now to the
okay.
point where I do want to do it again. Obviously, it is disheartening, every turn when there's these roadblocks, there's a law in front of you that's saying it's okay for you to do this.
That must be a bit frustrating. And I mean, and frankly, I was saying it when I was speaking just a few minutes ago with Ronan Levy, the man who was arrested when he went to pick up this shipment of hemp from your farm. I was asking him whether he thought there maybe needs to be more training for police officers and for FedEx drivers about, you know, what you're carrying and the legality of it and that sort of thing. Because clearly there was a case of mistaken identity here, shall we say. A botanical mistaken identity.
Absolutely. And you see the differences just between Vermont versus New York, too. I mean, in Vermont, FedEx did call the police on our package when we dropped it off. And again, I've shipped with them many times. I'm really transparent when I ship with them. I say, this is hemp. I'm shipping hemp. Here's all my paperwork. They actually take copies. They make copies of my paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
In every single box, I let them know, license, a letter from me, everything's in there, the test results. But someone did call the police, and the Williston PD came, and they looked at the paperwork, and they said, all good to go. I mean, this is hemp. You either call the buyer, let her know to pick it up if you don't want to send it, or send it. So,
right.
Obviously, there's a lapse in, systems, communication, and education. But especially, once that got to New York, the NYPD looked at the paperwork. I don't know where the paperwork went, but they looked at it, and they said, no way, this is hemp. So there is definitely a difference between states. I am happy during these times to be a Vermonter, that's for sure.
Yeah, I got to say, and the Williston PD, it sounds like they did it. They handled the whole thing pretty reasonably in the sense that they looked at it and said basically thumbs up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so good to go. And then, do you put some of the blame here on the FedEx driver who suddenly after getting that thumbs up from this police department of Vermont thinks he has to check it again with the police?
I put some blame with the systems with FedEx. They have come out and say we do not allow shipments of hemp, which is totally fine. But, I had done this previous times and they had said, yeah, it's fine. You can ship with us hemp. I mean, I told them what was in the boxes every time.
Mm-hmm.
So, there needs to be some training with the people at the front saying, no, actually, we can't ship hemp because that's fine. I would have gone to USPS. But also, if it's already been checked by the police, Why is that not coming up on their system saying, you know, no need to check this again, it's already checked out? Because when FedEx recloses those boxes, I don't know how they're closing them up. I don't know if they're leaving gaps in the boxes, so it looks suspicious at that point. So there's obviously a lapse in some system. If the FedEx driver, you know, from what I'm told, if they have suspicions that it's drugs, they are to report it, and I have no problem with that. But if it's already been reported, I mean, that seems unnecessary.
Yeah, it seems like you've got to go through that that checking process maybe once, but twice? What? And is there any chance that maybe what happened here in terms of the disappearing paperwork, the Williston PD pulls the paperwork out of the boxes and, you know, brings it over to a counter or a table or something, looks it over, and then kind of forgets to put it back in the boxes? Is that possible?
I don't see it as possible. I mean, what they were doing was making sure my paperwork was in the box. So I would assume that they're going to make sure it goes away and
all right,
it goes with the boxes. But there were, you know, there were 9 boxes. So plenty of paperwork. when I received the phone call from the officer that Saturday, he said there's no paperwork anywhere. So
I'm curious about this. You have a process there at the farm where you test and you make sure that this hemp is and refresh me, is it 0.3% or something like that, THC?
Yeah, currently the law stands as 0.3% Delta 9 THC.
Okay.
There's new hemp rules federally going into effect next year, not in Vermont, but next year federally that is 0.3%. Total THC, which will make that's a whole other issue. It'll be pretty impossible to grow hemp that is compliant that way. But this was 0.3 Delta 9. Mine was well below it. It was 0.18. In fact, when they tested it, eventually it was 0.06, so it went down. But compliant in any way you look at it. I test multiple times. I test when the hemp is in the field, and I also test when it's done, I hang dry it once it's done being hung, and once it's trimmed, I then test it to make sure that, you know, it's still compliant and it's still what the buyer would expect.
Okay. Do you ever find, you know, I brought some hemp into the barn here, it's hanging in the barn, it's drying, I'm testing it, and you find that it's at 0.35 or something, you know, a little bit over that limit.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah. I would be lying if I said that doesn't happen. I mean, it's a plant. It changes.
Yeah.
I use the compliant test. Because what's legal right now is your compliancy test that is you take when it's in the fields right before you harvest. So that for me, I use very stable genetics. I use Oregon CBD, and they've been breeding for 10 years, and they know what they're doing. So a big part of that is finding compliant and stabilized seed that is really consistent on its output. In terms of cannabinoid levels.
So you don't often run into this problem of it being just over?
I don't, but I do every once in a while, and I know, and any farmer would be lying to you if they said that they don't run into that
problem. So when you find a plant that's just over, or significantly over, whatever, do you burn it, or, I mean, what do you do with it?
Well, as I said, I didn't find a plant pre-harvest that was over, but... Mm-hmm. If it is over, the Agency of Agriculture in Vermont, again, very happy to be a Vermonter, they do have systems in place for you to be able to keep that crop. You know, they'll look at the seeds you use, make sure the genetics were supposed to be hemp. And there, especially in Vermont, there is a window between 0.3 and 1% right now.
Okay.
That if you are in that window, you're still compliant. You know, you get a warning.
So basically, that would be hemp. I'm going to not ship this out of state. But it's okay in Vermont.
Yeah,
sounds
exactly.
Like
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And by the way, does all of your hemp go to CBD, or, you know, I've seen hemp clothing and hemp rope and hemp other stuff. Does any of it go into?
Yeah, all of our hemp is CBD hemp flower. You know, there's a little bit different genetics for fiber and a seed crop. We do all CBD hemp flower currently, so it all goes to CBD.
I see. Okay. And so you package up this hemp. It's in 9 boxes, as you said, total of 106 pounds, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We package it in 1-pound bags.
Yeah.
That's something that we found all the buyers across the country. That's how they prefer it. And we put it in these, basically, you know, like a meat sealer bag. A little bit extra air. They're called terp lock bags. They take care of the terpenes really well.
And I'm sorry, you said you put it in 1 pound packages. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, I'm sure you saw that picture on Facebook, very proudly put up there by the NYPD.
Yeah.
And they have all these, they look like 1 pound bags kind of lined up on a couple of cafeteria tables or something, right?
Yeah. In the break room, looks like.
Yeah. And what did you think when you first saw that picture?
I will never forget it because it was so crazy to me. Buddy and I, my business partner, we had just dealt with this over the weekend. You know, the officers calling us up, and the Felino's is right next to City Market. We went over to get a bagel at City Market. We were standing in line, and someone texted me. I popped it up and saw the photo and just showed it to Buddy, and we just stared at each other with like open, gaping mouths. Like, this is Vermont.
I shouldn't laugh, but I gotta say.
No, it's so funny. And everyone we show it to, they do laugh, and then they say, I shouldn't laugh. But
yeah.
it's comical because that is hemp, and you're not going to get, I mean, maybe if you smoked a whole pound, you might get a buzz, but I mean, you're not going to get too high off that.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not something that, it's just comical. I mean, there's so many, I can imagine there's a lot more important things on the streets in New York to worry about than some Vermont grown hemp.
Is there any way for like the naked eye or an untrained person to tell the difference though?
No. And okay. Some people will say, yeah. Some people will say, well, the buds are denser if it's marijuana. But no, I mean, this is a plant that's been bred down from marijuana.
Yeah.
Has less than 0.3% THC. I mean, when the federal government wrote that law, breeders across the country went, hell yeah, let's make some CBD marijuana and we can call it hemp. And that's what we're all growing now. We are growing hemp that is, you know, a variety of marijuana that's bred down and down and down to not get you high, but to up the CBD to get you that relief, you know, from anxiety, pain, inflammation. And that's what we're now growing.
Okay. So, I got to say, I looked at the picture on Facebook and I said, boy, that sure does look like, you know, police officers standing with a big pot bust. I mean, that's what kind of, that was the whole idea.
And I don't blame them at all for, you know, looking into it. But when there's paperwork in order and you do, you know, they did a field test, which is a field test is there THC in this product?
Yeah. Okay.
And anything
above zero triggers the field test alarm or whatever. Okay.
Yeah. But there is obviously that's just when, you know, there's a gap in education. I mean, is it possible to have THC in hemp? Yes, there is, and it likely will be there.
They are talking about, in fact, given legal notice to the city of New York of their intent to sue the NYPD and the city. Jehala Dudley, do you have any plan to join that suit yourself?
As of now, no. It's not something I want to put myself or my farm through. But it's not totally off the table. I mean, there's the one thing that got to me was when the police are saying that we needed a license to just sell in New York. And that's untrue. That doesn't exist yet in New York law. That was signed into law a couple weeks ago by the governor there, and it will go into effect next year. But, you know, when officials partner your farm name with you being illegal and doing illegal activity in how you do your sales, et cetera, that's when, you know, that's when it starts to get a little messy for me. But
yeah,
I don't have any real plans. I mean, I don't want to be going through a year long thing, but you know, it's not off the table because this is a big lesson for everyone, I think, and it needs to continue to have the spotlight on it.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the reason I've decided to dip into this myself a couple months in, because I not only is a lawsuit pending now or about to be, I guess, which kind of makes it news again, but also just the fact that it's an ongoing issue. It's something that I think police departments around the country and others who deal with this, including shippers like FedEx or anybody else who is in that end of the business, they probably need to be aware of what's legal and what's not. And if we're going to have a legal hemp industry in the United States of America, which apparently we have decided to do. The federal government now says it's okay. And by the way, let me, speaking of the laws and what's in effect and what's not, you've mentioned a few minutes ago this limit of 0.3% THC or Delta 9 THC content in the hemp. That's the limit where if it's below that, you're okay, you're hemp. And if you're above that, you are legally marijuana. And do the same limits apply in New York, and is that a federal limit, or how does that work?
Yeah, currently the laws in New York are the same as the federal law, and the same as the base of the Vermont law, which is 0.38 Delta 9 THC. So
okay.
In this case, that is this is all compliant. If I was shipping to Pennsylvania, they're a little bit different. I believe it's 0.3% total. Theoretical. And so, same with Oregon. So there are states where I would not feel safe, or, you know, I would feel like I'm on the edge of compliance with shipping to, and therefore I might stay away from those states. But New York is in line with federal and in line with Vermont law.
And by the way, you mentioned earlier also that that may change. Federal law may actually start to, there are other forms, I guess, of THC, which are not the Delta 9. The Delta 9 is the psychoactive element or component of cannabis, but there are other types of THC which do not get you high, from what I understand. And what they're talking about doing is adding them all up. So that's,
yeah,
that would be tough.
To be a hemp farmer, you have to be pretty politically savvy, is what I'm finding out.
Sure sounds like it. Hey, Jill.
But not everyone is doing that. So.
Yeah, I guess not. Hey, Jahala Dudley, excuse me. I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. We are about out of time on this edition of the Dave Graham Show here in WDEV. Thank you very much for being my guest.
Thank you for covering it, Dave. Appreciate it.
All righty. Hey, that does get us up to the top of the hour here. It's pushing 11 o'clock in the morning, which is my quitting time. And I'll be back tomorrow for another edition of the Dave Graham Show. Meanwhile, stay tuned for Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio. And have a great second day of 2020, everybody.